This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Chamber of Secrets, Chapter 1, The Worst Birthday.
Oh, wow. Wow. We're in book two.
I feel like I need to change the intro line there so I don't say secrets twice in a row. I was reading it. I was like, wait a minute. This doesn't sound as good.
Unlock the secrets of
the chamber secrets. Of them. There's so many secrets.
Oh, man.
But we're in book two.
We are in book two. I think it's always kind of hilarious that the Chamber of Secrets is this mysterious chamber that exists beneath the school, as if Harry didn't literally close the last book in a mysterious chamber.
I know,
beneath the school.
Just a different. This isn't the Chamber of Secrets of Legend, but don't be alarmed, students. We have many secret chambers here at Hogwarts.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
This is one of those where it's like, did each of the founders have like their own secret basement where they would go and do their own experiments?
We do have at least one theory that each of the founders had like their own, like a specific room they created in the castle.
Yes,
right.
We do.
So
okay,
the
walk us through it. So, Chamber of Secrets.
The Chamber of Secrets is almost the problem with the theory, because it's like the idea is that Godric Gryffindor then would have created the headmaster office and like the
because of the Gryffindor.
Yeah, right. So the tell there is that there is the Gryffindor knocker on the headmaster's office. So maybe it wasn't initially intended as the headmaster's office. This was just Godric's office, like personal office.
Right.
And it went on to become the headmaster's office. But like the fact that there is a Gryffindor knocker, which is also the inspiration for the name of this show, if you couldn't tell.
I suspect at this point they put it together.
And then Rowena would have created the Room of Requirement, just because it's like a very like intelligent room. Helga would have created the kitchens and possibly the Great Hall, because they're sort of connected in that way.
It's always fun to imagine, or is this even just canon, that like underneath the Great Hall is like the same layout.
It is just canon. Okay.
And so like quite literally it's just like you're just transmuting like the like all the food from down here to the up there,
right? Just sending it straight up. Plus it's like the Great Halls where like everyone comes together, and that's very Hufflepuff.
Absolutely.
And then it's almost like then there's the Chamber of Secrets, which is like the one that Slytherin would have created. The almost issue being that like the other three would have created rooms for the rest of the school, whereas then he's like, "Yeah, no, I made one. Don't worry, you can't ask me questions about it." No, guys, it's a big secret. It's gonna be hilarious.
I shall not be telling people. I think there's a couple of different thoughts that I think come to my mind just as we discuss this. One of them is like, you know, we talked about, or you just mentioned, Godric's office eventually going on to be like the headmaster's suite, so to speak. Like one of the things that I feel like I have contemplated a lot, like whenever I've imagined like the founder series and what like the origination point for Hogwarts could have been, is like I think I could imagine at some point in time that it wasn't even explicitly like it was a school. It was a place where you could like educate one another on how to like improve our magical abilities.
Right.
But you have to imagine like this is a such like a much more rudimentary version of like what the wealth of knowledge surrounding all right, wizard like, kind would have been.
Right, like the pomp and circumstance. It's like it's more like the 10th Hunger Games and less like the 74th Hunger Games.
Yeah, it's a good comparison. Right, yeah. Yeah. It's like things. All the kinks haven't been quite worked out yet. And in the case of the Hunger Games, ultimately all of it's just for the worst.
Yes.
And like a lot of times I like to think that Hogwarts at one point in time was a safe haven for the magical community. And that's even part of the reason that it's like so concealed and protected is because like at some point in time it was like, well, there's no point in like undoing these enchantments. Like we may as well keep the students safe as long as we're at it. But like, I think, you know, the like persecution of people perceived to be magical during that particular era of time was probably rather significant in a way that the wizarding folk would have been highly unable to, you know, like stand against.
Right. And
the
like
non-magical community.
Like the castle also has like all these built in, has it like a built in army with like the suits of armor and stuff. And it's like that was put in the castle for a reason. Like they must have had something to defend against.
Yes. Yeah.
Like they
precisely.
Needed some kind of protection built into the school. It's like, otherwise there's no real reason your high school needs a magical army at its disposal.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So I think there must've been something there. But the other thing that like helps are the founders each made one of the rooms in the castle that makes the Chamber of Secrets less of a secret is that in like my own personal headcanon, I think you and I have talked about this, is that like the other three founders like definitely just knew about the basilisk at one point.
Oh,
so
sure.
Like
okay.
Slytherin could have like specifically made this chamber is like, this is where I'm going to keep the basilisk.
Right.
Like it's obviously a threat to people, but you know, we all love the basilisk and I can't get rid of it. It's a giant legendary creature that's helped us out of so many jams, but obviously it's quite deadly, so I made it its own room in the basement.
Right.
And then this is just personal headcanon, is that what, you know, eventually there's the crack and Slytherin leaves the school, is that the reason no one can find the chamber and that no one can remember what the monster is because he like hides the secret inside of Slytherin's locket when he leaves. And so it's kind of like the Fidelius charm. It's like they all knew about it at one point, but now it's like we know there is a basement and we know there is a monster, but like, what is it? We can't, like, they, like, magically can't remember.
Yes.
Because of the locket.
Right. And I could totally see that. I mean, I think it kind of, like, even stands to reason that, like, you know, I think part of, like, you know, Fantastic Beasts is all about is, like a lot of beasts are just kind of misunderstood. And if, like, you understand how to work with them in a way that is, like, positive, and that's exactly like what Newt has dedicated his life to, then they can be massive and terrific assets,
right?
Or otherwise just meant to be respected in some other capacity to exist in their most natural environments. But yeah, I could totally see a world where, I mean, with all the other defenses in place, I mean, the basilisk could have been, you know, sort of like their ace in the hole.
Oh, like literally in the hole too.
In the hole. Yeah. I think that's super cool. And again, like kind of going back to this idea that, you know, Hogwarts would have been a safe haven and a protected place for, you know, the wizarding population, it then eventually would have expanded over to the only exclusive wizarding town, which is Hogsmeade, directly next to it. So even that would sort of make sense, because it would be like, okay, all these people went, they all stayed in the castle, there was like education to be had, you know, in less of a traditional capacity. So like in my mind, I'm not even thinking of like 11-year-olds coming of age and going to school. This is just sort of like, you know, maybe somebody's teaching herbology to any spectrum of people who want to know more about magical plants.
Right. It's not like you age into it. It's just like, if you're a wizard at all, come over to the school and we'll teach you things.
Yeah. Like we should share knowledge. Yeah, exactly. And then at that point in time, I feel like Hogsmeade would almost be like the representation that like at some point in time, they were able to feel comfortable enough to expand to an area adjacent to the castle where they could then live in a much more known capacity.
Right.
Well. So anyway, kind of just a general deep dive on the title of the book.
On the title of the book, Chamber of Secrets.
Which I feel like we can partly do, because as we enter chapter one, there's an abundance of things that I think are happening here. And I think it's a well-crafted chapter, especially if you are the reader consuming this book based on like the original release dates.
Yes, like you can definitely tell reading it in 2023 that when this book was written, it very much had in mind, especially in the first chapter, like, let me catch the reader up on everything they might have forgotten in the past year and a half between release dates or whatever.
Yeah, so this is kind of like one of those funny things where it's like stories can like you could almost imagine them being told differently, or maybe even once more time had passed, because this is still going to be like, you know, inside of the 90s, and maybe there's a greater expectation for like the reader's relationship with a specific story and their willingness to have like just be up to date by the time they're picking up the second installment.
Well, yeah, and I mean, certainly at this point too, even but like by the time Chamber had come out, Harry Potter wasn't the phenomenon Harry Potter yet.
Yes,
like it was a popular book or whatever, but it wasn't like just assumed that everyone who bought the book was just like extremely well versed in the entire wizarding world.
Precisely. Yeah. So I think coming into this chapter, basically what you get is a lot of kind of like recap of the previous story. You're getting a bit of reacquainted with just how awful life is at the Dursleys. But I think sort of like the signature touch of the particular chapter is the very last sentence, is basically when Harry goes back up to his bedroom. The trouble was there was already somebody there.
Yeah. It's like almost the same sentence from the end of chapter 16.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Where it's like, oh man, what a good cliffhanger. Yeah. But I think what this does, and just trying to get into the mind again of that reader from, you know, the late 90s or whatever, is basically it's sort of like, okay, like, yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah. So we went to a magical school. Okay. Yeah. Ron and Hermione are his friends. Oh yeah. The Dursleys, they're the worst. And you know, you're sort of like, but like otherwise it's kind of like a light chapter, like not like Harry mows the lawn, you know, like not a lot happens.
Yeah, not much happens. Like, he basically just sort of sees Dobby in the bushes, but you don't even know who Dobby is yet.
Right, but yeah. Then if you get to the end of it, and you're like, wait a second, who's in his room?
Who's in his room?
It's like, well, it's kind of interesting. It's like, there's not supposed to be anybody in the Dursleys. Yeah. You know, like, who are the eyes in the bush? You know, so I feel like if you're picking it back up, and you're getting through this chapter, and even if you're like, well, you know, like, nothing really, like, wild is happening, you get to, like, the last sentence, and you're like, all right, I'm back.
I got
like,
it. I gotta turn the page.
I'm turning the page. I want to know what's up. And sure enough, you're introduced to, you know, then like a brand new creature, which is going to be a lot of fun. So anyway, I feel like that's sort of like my quick synopsis of chapter one. But now we can do the nitty gritty.
Now we can go. Yeah, we can go do the nitty gritty. So let's just start with the chapter art here for The Worst Birthday, which features Harry sitting on a bench, and you can see Dobby's eyes over in the bush. And what's your take on the art on this one, Ben?
I get such like Where's Waldo vibes.
I hate it. Yeah, it's we're not starting off on a good note chapter art wise. I'm like, first of all, I was like, when does Harry even sit on a bench? And it turns out he does. I went and found it, in the chapter.
He even paints the bench
in this chapter. Yeah. But yeah, there's something about this just screams your head. It's very like Where's Waldo, or it looks like a Sunday morning comic strip or something.
Yeah, like bazooka bubblegum.
Yeah, there's something a little off-putting about it. I don't exactly know what it is, but it's not super magical looking. I didn't love this one. I was like, okay, all right, whatever.
The one thing I'll say is that because, you know, so often I'm now listening to the book, so I don't even get exposed to the chapter art at all. The one thing I will say is that like this concept of like Dobby's eyes being visible in the bushes is always kind of like one of those things where I'm like, I don't like... I think as a kid, literally what I was imagining was the bush itself magically had eyes, or like somehow like Dobby was like mirroring his face onto the bush. I never could quite picture in my head what it meant that he could like look at the bush and see these two, you know, bright yellow eyes.
Right, like staring out
and like how that would look. But like I would say that what the chapter art does do is sort of gives me some imagination as to like how the eyes are almost like glowing in what is otherwise kind of like a shadowy area. So like the light reflecting off of his eyes is kind of making like the eyes themselves visible where like the rest of Dobby wouldn't be.
Right, yeah. I think this is also like a case where like Dobby's eyes like in the movies aren't given the like big bulbous treatment. He just sort of has like regular looking eyes.
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah, that's
so
true.
Like, you know, maybe you don't always think of Dobby as having these like huge eyes the way it's described in the book, but yeah.
Protuberant
eyes, yeah. As it were.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's the artwork here. I thought this was, it's funny that you mentioned the last sentence, because the very first sentence, I think it was just maybe I don't know if unusual, but In the first sentence of Sorcerer's Stone and in the first sentence of Chamber of Secrets, the Dursley's full address is listed in both.
number four Privet Drive.
Yeah. Like, here's where we are. Like, what an interesting, like, I wonder how intentional that was. Like, this is how the book will start, and this will immediately put you in the world again. Like, it's exactly how the last book started.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, and this is sort of interesting in a total aside, kind of secondary to the books themselves, but this was something that I was noticing when I was pulling some clips for an episode of Super Carlin Brothers yesterday, is the frequency, or this may even be true for all of the Harry Potter films, that they end with a shot of Harry, Ron, and Hermione together.
Not Prisoner of Azkaban.
Oh, yeah, because Harry does like
the freeze frame on the firebolt with like the smudge face.
Yes, you're right. Well, okay, so what was interesting to me is I was like, man, every time I finish the series, I just want to go back and start at the beginning again, is I think what we're saying in the video. So I go to like the last scene, sans the epilogue, from Deathly Hallows, and they're all three standing there just like together in a row, you know, like with the crumbling castle sort of behind them.
Yeah.
And then if you cut to the ending of Sorcerer's Stone, it's right after Hagrid has given Harry the photo album, yeah. And they're like all three getting like on the train together, and it's just like, oh, that's so crazy that like literally, like if you go from the end to the beginning, it's like the same shot, which I just thought was kind of fun. So
that is, that's
anyway,
good.
A little bit of continuity from you know, our intros and outros, I guess.
Neat.
Yeah,
I love this. So otherwise, on the first page here, we get Harry's just at breakfast. You find out that Hedwig has not been able to fly anywhere. I love the line from Uncle Vernon where he's like, "Do I look stupid?" And it's just like, it's such a funny thing. It's like, you can almost like, as you're reading it, it's like, yes, you look stupid. it's like he's trying to make this point about how non-stupid he looks, and it's like the exact opposite is being achieved
due to his bit of fried egg dangling from his bushy mustache.
I know, gosh, what a! It's like annoying me how distracting it is staring at him in my mind's eye. I'm like, just fix that egg.
I know.
It's get like that egg off your face.
Can someone let him know, please? Yes. Please. Let's rectify that problem.
Yeah. Also, I think it's funny that Dudley, one of his first lines is, "I want more bacon," which to me, it's like, it's surprising to me almost that he still eats pork-based products after having a pig's tail the last year. He's like, did you not get the joke at all, man? Like,
oh, man.
You're still eating bacon? You were like half pig for a year, okay?
I know. I have never picked up on that before, but that actually, I feel like that is also very intentional.
Yeah.
That like we've literally like left. The last we've seen Dudley, the last exchange we've had with him basically was him having a pig's tail.
Yeah.
And now the return is his eating bacon.
That is eating bacon.
Man, that totally is just way over my head. The next line is, "There's more in the frying pan, sweetums," from Aunt Petunia. This frying pan gets some serious action.
It does in
this particular chapter.
I know.
Where I'm skipping ahead a little bit now, but at some point in time, Petunia will be cleaning said frying pan and swing it at Harry's head.
Yeah,
which is like one of those things where it's like, oh my gosh!
Yeah,
like the level of actual abuse that Harry is enduring underneath the Dursleys is like terrible.
I know. And I'm like, so is bad. This like what I mean, in my mind, I'm like picturing like maybe it's not like a cast iron frying pan, but like we don't know that it's not, you know?
Oh
like,
my gosh.
I mean, and honestly, it doesn't matter. Any frying pan you hit someone with
is going
to hurt.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's like it's such a violent object.
Yes.
As we learned so clearly in the film Tangled.
Yes. I mean, which I also literally watched last night.
Oh, no way. That's so funny. Okay.
And then also, just speaking of the frying pan, I highlighted this as Dudley is sitting at the table with his large bottom, which is drooping over either side of the kitchen chair, he says, "Pass the frying pan." And I'm like, are they setting the frying pan directly on the table with the bacon on it? Like, am I crazy? Or I've never been in anyone's house where they're serving the bacon directly out of the pan on the table.
Yeah, no. The bacon definitely goes into onto a plate.
Like onto a plate, yeah.
With like a paper towel.
Not at the Dursleys.
To like absorb some of that grease.
Can't be bothered with that.
Yeah. No, I mean, the whole scene, I really do think is just intended to just show you just how truly awful the Dursleys are, because then as you scroll down just a little bit more, basically Harry says, "You've forgotten the magic word," to the request of passing the frying pan, and Vernon ends up just going absolutely off and in all caps says, "I warned you, I will not tolerate mention of your abnormality under this roof." And I'm like, man, that is rude, like in every single way, all the time and always.
Yeah,
it's just like, gosh, you right. guys are so like you're so indefensible.
I mean, it is like, especially because it's like it doesn't feel like if Harry's abnormality was like of a more Muggle variety that they would be treating him any differently. You know, like if he was just like a physically handicapped person.
Oh, sure. Or something, yes. You know? I mean, it
like
makes
they would
feel
still
like,
be bothered by it.
Yes, absolutely. It just seems like that's the kind of folk that the Dursley happen to be, yeah. which is just unacceptable. Let's see here. Going into the next page, though, there's just a line that just like it's basically just like talk like Harry trying to like calm Uncle Vernon down, who is breathing like a
winded rhinoceros. I know, I highlighted that too. I was yep. like, what a great description.
Yes. But basically it says like Harry Potter wasn't a normal boy. Harry Potter was not a normal boy. As a matter of fact, he was as not normal as it is possible to be. Harry Potter was a wizard. Yes. And I just highlighted that and just said, yeah, he is. It's just like, I don't know why. It's just sort of like, it's like, that's like one of those like punch the air kind of moments. Like, yes.
Yeah.
He is a wizard.
I know. I highlighted that as well because I think it's interesting that it's like, I like the description. He's as not normal as it is possible to be because like, like what they're saying is that Harry's a wizard, but like, it's true. That sentence remains true if he was sitting at like the Weasley's table, you know, like, even within the wizarding world, he's pretty much as not normal as it's possible to be.
That's a good point. Yeah, yeah. He's kind of the exception to a lot of rules. He's very critical to everything.
Right. Him and Voldemort. I think Dumbledore says, like, you guys have traveled into realms of magic no one else has even, you know, seen before.
Right, right. Yeah. Like, so it's like we're literally witnessing. I mean, going again back to like the founders and the creation of Hogwarts and the rudimentary magic they had at the time. It's like this is like a full millennium later.
Right.
And Harry is on the cutting edge of like what the new magic is, which means the founders, this is like one of those things where people are like, George Washington didn't know dinosaurs existed, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, the founders who are some of the most, you know, powerfully magical people who have ever existed have no clue the things that Harry and Voldemort are doing.
Right. Right. Well, this is an interesting thing because it's like they're Voldemort and Dumbledore refer to like the sacrificial love as like some sort of ancient charm
sure.
or something. Like it seems like it is known of, but like, how could it be known? How can Harry be the only one who has survived death and it's a known of thing without someone else having survived, you know?
That's like, a good question.
I mean, I guess it is possible that someone could have cast sacrificial protection, and then it's similar to how like Harry casts it over the defenders of Hogwarts, where it's not like any of them then survive death, but they are able to like break the charms of Voldemort or something.
Yeah,
like maybe people like know this is a way to protect someone, but no one's ever actually gone as far as to test it against Avada Kedavra.
Yeah, yeah, or even if like ancient magic in some capacity refers to magic that has been like somehow like lost time entirely, mm-hmm. like even as if there was like a heyday of magic before its eventual like revival. You know, which sort of stands the reason if again, you know, you're imagining a world where Hogwarts, or even just like the wizarding people go to such lengths to hide themselves from the rest of the world.
Right.
It probably means that they weren't terribly welcomed by the rest of the world, which probably means that the rest of the world knows a reason why to not welcome them, which would probably mean that at some point in time they did have more power.
I can see something. Yeah.
I'm trying to move like the sliders around in the logic puzzle
right.
of my brain. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, possibly that's how they got there. Like what you're seeing is like the founding of Hogwarts is the re-rise of magic. And the reason that so much effort goes to like maintaining its secrecy is the knowledge of like what happens if the secrecy is exposed.
Because
it's happened before.
Right. There's also, I know Hogwarts Legacy explores like quote unquote ancient magic.
Right.
As like something that like you, the main character, is like capable of seeing in the way that the other students are not.
Right.
And
yeah.
How it's like there have been other students in the past who have like discovered certain things similar to what you as the protagonist are doing.
Okay.
And those like unlock certain secrets around Hogwarts. There's also like when Dumbledore is in the cave in Half-Blood Prince, it sounds like there's kinds of ancient magic at play as he's feeling around. So there is like a, a different kind of magic that seems to exist.
Right, right. Well, and, I mean, that's the other one as well, like where when you enter into the objects like the Deathly Hallows, eventually, you know, it's like they seem like truly remarkable in creation, or the veil at the Department of Mysteries, or the pensive inside of Dumbledore's office. Like, you know, there are magical objects that seem to exceed the boundaries of magic that should have been available upon their original creation,
right. Mm-hmm.
which does make me wonder if there is this like X factor, kind of similar to like the ability to speak to snakes, where it's almost like a quasi, I don't know if, I mean, hereditary doesn't feel like the right way, but like a lottery draw type of situation where like sometimes it arises, and when
right.
it does, it's like that person is going to have unique capabilities, but then even beyond that, it's whether or not they manifest them, like
right.
what they do with them from
right.
there,
mm-hmm.
You know, is the next piece of the you know, the equation. So I don't know. It's particularly interesting. I don't even know how we got so sidetracked. I feel like we're talking about.
I know. I was worried coming into this chapter, like not a lot happens. Like, what are we going to talk about? But no, we're doing okay.
Yeah.
I do think it's funny down at the bottom of this page where Harry's like, what did the Dursleys care if Harry lost his place on the house Quidditch team because he hadn't practiced all summer? Yeah. I was like, Harry, first of all, that's not a concern. Like, you literally made the team without a tryout last year, or having ever played the game or even heard of the game last year. And
yes.
since then, you've done nothing except catch the snitch in your mouth and end the shortest game in Hogwarts history. So, like, you're fine,
dude. You're doing good. I don't think anybody is, like, on the fence about whether or not you deserve your spot on the team, especially when not being there is when Gryffindor gets, like, demolished by
Ravenclaw.
Yeah.
Yes, possibly. And possibly Cho Chang. We don't know when she makes the team.
That's a good point.
I guess that would mean she was a second year. So, right.
This is another one of those things, though, where I feel like and it's kind of interesting because as you see, if you look at the books as like installments as part of seven, you sort of have like books 1, 2, 3 where it feels like the stakes overall are much more like down to earth. They're much more relative to that of like a teenager. And so
yeah.
like, you know, I bring it up a whole bunch in Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone, the threat of being like expelled from school and how much you're aware of how bad life is with the Dursleys, that you're sort of like really resonating. It's like it doesn't even matter if you like Hogwarts, you're just like, at least he's away from the Dursleys. And like, so
right.
worst case scenario is this world where like everything's over because he just has to go back and live a miserable existence with them.
Yeah.
But I feel like we see a lot of this, and this is sort of like, you know, for books 1 through 3, again, the stakes are kind of small. And then like 4 starts to kind of like bridge the gap, like where Harry is still for the most part of the book dealing like with a popularity kind of contest.
Right. Like
you know, like down to earth problems, asking a girl to a dance.
Yeah.
You know, like there are things that like any high schooler may have had to endure. And then on the other side of it, like even the other side of Goblet of Fire is like, you know, when he enters into the graveyard and Voldemort is back, and he
right.
has an army of fully grown, fully trained wizards at his disposal, and like Order of the Phoenix is like, we are at war with the government, you
right
know?
Yeah.
Like, it's like
whoa,
okay, these are not typical high school problems anymore. But I find it interesting, and that was part of like what made this line stand out to me as well, was just sort of like, it's like the stakes right now are like, oh man, how much of a bummer would it be to us the readers who are rooting for Harry to like lose a spot on the Quidditch team? Like, that would be so disappointing.
It would be. Also, the other ridiculous thing is that if Harry were to lose a spot on the Quidditch team, it would like all of the other students, like were already there. Like they already could have tried out to be Seeker, except for the first years.
Who can't play Seeker?
Right.
Yeah.
Who like apparently never make the
Yeah.
So like the only event in which Harry doesn't get his spot on the house team is because right behind him is the next best Quidditch player in a century.
Yes. Oh, this is the other thing too, is that like, well, so no, what grade is Cormac in?
Cormac, I think he's a year ahead of them.
He's a year ahead
yeah.
of them. Okay. This is like always one of those things too, where it's like, surely he should have outplayed someone. Like, it's always
not Oliver Wood.
Not, I mean, maybe not Oliver Wood. I mean, it just seems like Cormac is just like a natural built athlete. It's like, how is this guy like getting through school without ever being drafted?
I know, right? Yeah, like, why isn't he ever on the team for anything?
Yeah, he just kind of shows up eventually.
Just shows up and he's like
super jock who can catch a fly out of the air with his fingers.
And like somehow they've like never encountered him before in the Gryffindor common room.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right,
like, hey, this guy's in your house,
and he's apparently like huge, like broad, like just a big guy. It's like you seem like he seems like we should see him.
I know. Right. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. So. excuse me. I'm sorry.
All right. Yeah. There is a sentence on the next page. I don't know if this was the first time it said it was describing Harry's appearance. If in case you forgot what he looks like, it says he wore round glasses and on his forehead was a thin lightning shaped scar. I wasn't sure if that was the first time you get a description of Harry's glasses as being like the iconic circular round glasses.
Oh, interesting.
Or not.
Interesting. Yeah, once again, it always brings me back to the question or the day in which the Dursleys very begrudgingly would have had to have taken Harry to the optometrist, you know, to like have his...
Get his eyes sorted.
Get his eyes sorted. So it's like, you almost have to wonder. It's like, it's kind of interesting that it becomes such like an iconic element of his appearance because the Dursleys likely are the ones who provided it to him.
I know, it is. Like, it was like, there's always that. It's always right on his face.
Right, yep, right there.
And then it also mentions that, like, yes, Harry is not just unusual in that he's a wizard. He's unusual even for a wizard because of the scar on his head. So there's cool. That's cool. There is then this next line, it says, at the age of 1 year old, Harry had somehow survived a curse from the greatest sorcerer of all time. This is just like interesting, like Avada Kedavra dodging. Like it's very similar to how pre-learning about the Dementors, they just are called the Azkaban guards until you know the word, and then it's always Dementors. And it's like, it's funny to me that knowledge of the Avada Kedavra curse is like withheld from you for so long. It's just like, he tried to perform a deadly curse on you. And it's like, there's really just the one.
Yeah. It's like, there's not a whole lot of reason to not just say Avada Kedavra from the very beginning.
Yeah.
But either which way. This is another one of those things too, though, that I remember as a child reading, like, you know, and it says, Harry had escaped with his lightning scar, and somehow nobody understood why Voldemort's powers had been destroyed the instant he had failed to kill Harry. Like, it's really interesting to try to just as your own thought experiment, attempt to go back in time and put yourself back in the headspace where you don't know the answer to this.
Right.
Because it's like now I can read that sentence and it largely means, I mean, I wouldn't say that it means nothing to me. It's just that, like, it's hard to imagine not knowing.
Right. Yeah. Like what happened?
Yeah, exactly. But like, I do remember like that this mystery drove me nuts as a kid. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, you go through book after book after book and it's like,
still not answered.
Still don't know. It's like, you know, the fact that the through line is preserved. Like, I mean, it's one of those things like where it's hard to know if like for me to ever imagine like writing my own story, it would be so hard to like hold on to a piece of information for years and years in books and books.
Yeah.
Like without ever like giving like the flourish.
I know. You know, like it'd be so hard. The other one is like why Snape hates Harry or why Dumbledore trusts Snape. That's the other big one. That's like, it's just maintained like all the way through until like the second to last chapter of the whole series.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's like, wow.
Man.
Wow. I really wanted to know that this whole time.
Yeah.
But it makes it very satisfying when you eventually do it.
It does. It does.
I did a little cross out here in the very next sentence. It says, so Harry had been brought up by his dead mother's sister and her husband. He had spent 10 years with the Dursleys. And I crossed it out and I wrote 9.75.
Oh, that's right.
I love our little 9 3/4 realization.
That's right.
I just think it's super fun. So anyway, so he spent 9 3/4 years with the Dursleys. Mm-hmm. Yep.
No coincidence there. As speaking of Harry's birthday, though, today, the day of the chapter, is Harry's 12th birthday, which, of course, the Dursleys have completely forgotten, other than Dudley, who comes to remind Harry that he knows what day it is and is just loving how much his parents aren't paying attention to him.
Yep, absolutely. This is another one of those kind of interesting ones. I may have brought this up once upon a time before, but when I met my wife Alice for the first time, one of the first things we ever talked about was Harry Potter and how she was planning. I was writing a Harry Potter script and she was writing for a video and she was planning a Harry Potter party that she was going to be hosting like a month later, which was really fun. And she was going dressed as Golden Snitch. And I was like, well, I've got to see how that plays out. But the other interesting thing is that my wife Alice also shares Harry's birthday, which I just was always kind of like, that's so wild.
What are the odds?
It felt like one of those things where I'm like looking around. I'm like, did somebody send her here? Is
I
this
know,
a
right?
bit? Like,
right. Someone, come on.
How could this be? Anyway, so
that's fantastic.
I always thought that was really cool. Good omen.
Yes, that is a good omen.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish, but that is really just the start, because from there you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped, because like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good, and they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening it's already passed, but like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can, and it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think honestly kids would love this, because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's see. Moving down, we have the Dursleys instructing Harry to be in his room, pretending he doesn't exist, which, again, just on his birthday, just so terrible. Like, what I want you to do when people come over is go upstairs, don't make a sound. In fact, actively think about how you don't exist.
Yeah.
You're not really here.
I know.
Yeah.
This is one of those really interesting things, though, because this chapter outlines a couple of bits of it that I think are very, very relatable and just good life observations, which is that, like, I don't think that Harry expects the Dursleys to be terribly nice to him. So them behaving in a way that is in a consistent manner to how they've always behaved is almost sort of like, you know, it's just par for the course. Like, I mean, Not to, again, I'm not defending the Dursleys. I mean, it's awful the way that they treat
him.
But I think it's something that I feel like I've come to relate to a lot, which is the fact that what's really bothering Harry is that it's his birthday and all summer he hasn't heard from his friends.
Right.
You know, and like, so what's really bothering him is that it's like, it wouldn't be so bad if the people who didn't like me continued to not like me.
Right.
What's hard is when you feel like the people who did like you have stopped.
Right.
And I think that's sort of like, I tend to relate to this phenomenon a lot, where it's like, you know, if there was somebody who already didn't agree with me, then I'm not expecting for them to magically agree with me. But if there's somebody who I have like now let down, it's like, oh,
right.
That hurts.
Yeah.
That hurts.
Yeah, it is worse.
And so that's a lot of like what Harry is dealing with. And of course, at this point in time, we would have no idea why, because the last we've seen, Ron and Hermione, they both literally put their own lives on the line to help Harry in, you know, his quest for the Sorcerer's Stone.
Right, you know, like they promised to write to him. Ron says he's going to invite him over.
Yeah, but then for some unknown reason, you're just sort of like, but they didn't write him any letters at all. Did they just get home and forget? Like, do they not care? Or are they, even Ron, you could almost see a world where he would just get home and he'd be so busy with life at home and he's got all of his siblings. And there's lots of distractions.
Stuff.
But it feels like Hermione, is also going to be a little bit isolated from the world that she's kind of come to know as her own reality. It seems like that would be the one where I'd be like, man, it really seems strange that Hermione has it written.
It does. Yeah, it would absolutely. Also, as I'm thinking about it, because I think each of them has written him actually many letters that Dobby has intercepted.
Yes.
And it's immediately making me think how much time and effort is Dobby putting into this endeavor that all summer he has successfully been on the lookout literally every time an owl came to the house. He must be there in all of his spare time.
Yeah. Well,
since summer started.
But I think this is part of the extreme power of house elves.
Yeah.
I think that they are this to me is it's almost in keeping with what we eventually learn about them. I just think that they are just so overlooked in terms of what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also interesting, especially as we, and I'll save some of it for the next chapter, like the lengths that Dobby has been able to go to, despite the fact that it would probably be contrary to the perspectives, intentions, whatever of his masters,
mm-hmm.
which is something that it seems house elves are just magically bound to.
Yeah.
So it's also one of those things that will eventually make me love Dobby just so very much, because
right.
he's literally he himself is overcoming his own programming for the good of everyone.
Right.
And he shows it in weird ways.
He does show it in weird ways. The other thing that for Dobby's plan, what a weird thing I'm just sort of thinking about now is that Draco and Lucius, or Lucius must be, I don't know who he's talking about this to, but obviously that's who Dobby's getting the information from, the terrible things are going to be happening at Hogwarts, and that's why Harry shouldn't go. Lucius must be having these conversations with somebody the moment summer starts, the moment Draco gets home, because at least has the conversation before Ron is able to send any communication to Harry, because
right.
those letters should have gotten to Harry, but right away Draco must walk through the door Harry Potter, Dad, you're not going to believe it.
He's not cool, man.
He's not cool. I don't like that kid. He ruined the house competition for him. What can we do about it? And he's no worries. I'll buy you and six of your friends in Nimbus 2001 and I'll unleash a terrible monster. It'll be okay, Draco.
we can solve this.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, is that Draco himself, Lucius must be doing it in reserves enough that Draco doesn't know.
Right. So, yeah, who is Lucius speaking out loud to about this plan? Just Narcissa? Because Draco doesn't know about it.
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's hard to know, it's hard to know. Let's see, especially because we eventually know that Lucius's real plan is, I think, to try to plant it with a Weasley in order to incriminate them while also disposing of an incriminating possession of his own.
I guess that is part of it. Yeah, because raids are happening and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. So I don't know. That feels like a very multifaceted question. It would be so interesting to just be a fly on the wall for that conversation.
But he knows that giving the diary away will open the Chamber of Secrets.
Or that could.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he knows enough that should happen. He doesn't know it's a Horcrux, so that Voldemort's soul is literally in there.
Right. Because that's the thing where Dumbledore is I have a feeling if Lucius Malfoy actually knew what he possessed, he never would have been so careless with it.
Right. Which is another one of those things where it's if Voldemort could have legitimately felt he trusted someone, or had enough in him to trust somebody to tell them the truth, then he would have been way better off. But of course he can't, which is to his own demise.
As per always,
it's always Voldemort's really his own undoing.
Yes.
Anyway, moving on. This is maybe the cringiest line in the whole book, and I hate it so much. And it is, and I think it's supposed to be cringy, but it is what Dudley is going to say to the Masons when he gets there. He says, "We had to write an essay about our hero at school, Mr. Mason, and I wrote about you." And I'm just I hate this line so much, because it's there's no scenario. As far as Mr. Mason is concerned, this kid has never even met him before.
I know.
Why? There's it's not believable as the adult to the child that, like, it's so, it's so clearly set up. And like the dirt, like they should be like, Dudley, that's adorable. Don't say that, because he'll know that's not true, because you've never met. And he's not like a heroic person. He's just a guy with a job.
Oh,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
And it's also just like, we had to write an essay for school. Like, it's summer, dude. Like, nothing. Oh, I just hate it. I hate that sentence so much. And it's like, I think you're supposed to. I think it's just supposed to be cringy.
Yes. But no, I totally agree with you. I highlighted it as well and just put, oh.
I know. I was like, no. Yeah. No. Moving on. They're, of course, they're hoping that this deal goes through so they could shop for their vacation home in Mallorca, their just favorite place in the world. I do love that. This is one of those things I never really noticed, is how much the Dursleys just love Mallorca.
I know. Yeah. It's like, it'd be interesting to know. And I mean, this is like a question for like British listeners. It's just simply like what. Like, I wonder what, like, is Mallorca, like, and I do not mean to throw any amount of shade whatsoever or at anyone for any reason, but is it, like, would it be, like, retiring to, like, Florida? Like,
oh,
which is,
right,
like, a rather common thing, you know, for Americans to do.
Like, or is this when, like, super rich people in New York, like, somewhere in the Hamptons?
Oh, you know? Yeah, that's a good point. Because it doesn't feel like, I mean, as much as the Dursleys subscribe to, you know, this sort of like suburban cookie cutter lifestyle, and they do seem to do reasonably well for themselves, they still seem firmly like in what I would interpret as like middle class,
right?
You know,
yeah. Like, I mean, they like, just live in the suburbs,
right? Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I like the Hamptons would seem like, and again, this is just my own interpretation, but it's like that does seem like 1% or kind of wealth,
right? Yeah, it does feel like that. So I don't know what kind of drill order Mr. Mason's about to drop on them.
I do like the fact that his last name is Mason, though, because a mason is somebody who builds with like, stone and blocks. So
right,
it's like, it's on the nose. I get it.
There it is.
Yep. But so then from there we do start to see a little bit more of like, you know, the rivalry, I guess, if you want to call it that, between Dudley and Harry occurring in this chapter, which is basically when, you know, Harry is outside on the garden bench. He's staring absentmindedly into the hedge, and the hedge was staring back, with those two enormous green eyes. I think I said yellow earlier. The green eyes. And Dudley comes out and is like sort of taunting Harry in a way that feels like I almost feel like sophisticated for what I expect from Dudley. Like he's like, I know what day it is. Like, I know that you're being slighted today. Like it feels much more like Dudley to have just forgotten entirely.
Right. Yeah. You know? But like, he's like, there is a bit of like active, like joy in the way in which Harry is not getting special treatment on this day.
Do you suppose on any level that this is maybe, and I'm going to go out on a huge limb here.
Okay.
This is actually giving Dudley like the tiny, and I can't even call it foreshadowing because no part of me thinks it's intentional in this way, but like the fact that Dudley actually knows Harry's birthday, is this in any way, shape, or form a small indicator to the fact that like a lot of what Dudley has been taught his whole life is to like kind of ape the opinions and thoughts of his parents, but like in the meantime, like also knows things about Harry, like where maybe like Vernon and Petunia are literally forgetting about Harry's birthday.
Right. Like, yeah, that is a good question. Like, do you think they have are ignoring it on purpose, or did they just actively forget?
Yeah, that's the question. Because if Dudley remembers it at the very least, and again, I'm trying to pull a mile out of an inch here.
Yeah.
It means he knows Harry's birthday.
That's true.
Which is like, you know,
which is maybe more than you can say for his parents.
Yes, correct.
Right.
Correct. Yeah. So that's always one of those things where I can't ever give Vernon and Petunia a pass, but there's a part of me that is also like, Dudley is still the product of something he had no control over, which is the thoughts and opinions of his parents.
Right.
And it's like, for better or for worse, and I would say the same thing about Draco, that's hard to overcome.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and that's the type of thing where I think a lot of times, once you see people go out into the world and maybe they have like their own individual experiences, things change. And it seems like for Dudley, by the time, you know, like Harry is they're parting ways forever and ever, like Dudley's kind of like, I don't think you're a waste of space, which again, you know, it's like you're trying to make a mile out of an inch,
yeah,
you know, for some kindness from Dudley here, because it's not exactly the nicest way to phrase it, but it feels like there's like a beacon of positivity that is finding its way out of this boy,
right?
And so anyway, I'm maybe we can grant him
just a little bit of credit there.
A grain.
Even though he came, or even if it's like, yeah, he knows his birthday, so he like does care a little, even though he's using that knowledge just to bully Harry.
To hurt him anyway. Yeah, yeah.
I do love the fake magic words that Harry retorts back with, jiggery pokery, hocus pocus, swiggly wiggly. Which is like, it's such a funny like, oh, those are sort of magic words that you as a person who hadn't read Harry Potter yet might associate with magic.
Well, this is also a really interesting one, because like hocus pocus would probably be like, you know, in the exact same column of well-known magical words as abracadabra.
Yeah, I'm most surprised abracadabra wasn't in there.
Yes.
Because abracadabra, if you don't know, is supposed to be like the way that muggles have misheard Avada Kedavra.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So, and maybe that's intentional in that capacity, where right. it's like that one's been like tucked into like the back pocket. It's like, right.
Hold on.
You'll see it eventually.
Yeah, no, well, yeah. You'll get there.
It'll
yeah.
get there.
But you're right, hocus pocus is in there. So I wonder if there's a magical spell in Harry Potter that sounds like hocus pocus. Nothing is coming to mind immediately.
Yeah, no, nothing specific.
Nope.
I don't know enough of the underlying etymology of any of the rest of those. If jiggery yep. pokery or squiggly wiggly have additional meanings,
right?
But I suppose it's possible if at least hocus pocus was selected, these other two could be something. Squiggly wiggly just sounds like gibberish to me.
Yeah, it all just sort of sounds like gibberish. Anyway, for doing this is where Aunt Petunia aims a heavy blow, which I also underlined was like, geez,
yeah, I know,
with
yeah.
a soapy frying. Come on, man. Like, not just like I swung it at him, like, don't you do that again. It's like I reared back
yes,
and tried
yes.
to inflict damage.
The other thing that's going through my mind, and I know this shouldn't be my priority, is I'm like, you're about to send like soap and bacon grease all over your apparently pristine kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not worth it. It's not worth it in any capacity, yeah. but you know.
Also, this is just like the difference between reading this as a child and I think reading this as a 35-year-old. But there's the next paragraph is like the ways in which Harry has to pay for it. And it says, Harry cleaned the windows, washed the car, mowed the lawn, trimmed the flower beds, pruned the roses, and repainted the garden bench. And I just like wrote a note and I was like, is it bad that this sounds like a very pleasant day to me?
Like, I know.
What a day.
I know.
Like, so productive.
This is not terribly dissimilar to literally how I spend my Saturdays
I know.
At this point in time. I just put a note next to that and I just said, this is an impressive amount of work though.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, good on Harry.
Takes him to 7:30 PM, which I just wrote down as sort of like what kind of dinner part? You're waiting the Masons wait to eat dinner until 7:30? Like, come on, it seems like a late party.
Right.
Know.
Yep. Yep. No, it does. It does indeed. Mm-hmm. And this is like, I don't know at this stage, like maybe this was a lot more common for like sales meetings back in the day would be like to go to each other's homes.
Yeah.
But like in the professional environment of the modern day, this feels like it would cross lines of some kind or something. Like maybe it doesn't. Like
that is interesting. Yeah, I don't know.
Like it wouldn't seem strange to me to like for like colleagues or like maybe it's like you know, host like a like you know, like your manager or something like that, like possibly, you know, at your home. But like I don't know if it feels more or less unlikely given that these are people who he is like attempting to like close a sale with or something. Like there's way too much obvious underlying intention for me to ever attend one of these things where it's like this is someone who just wants something from
well,
me.
Well, I think Mr. Mason isn't arriving like, well, this Vernon guy who typically sells drills probably just wants to be buds.
Yeah, inviting me into his home.
Right, like I think he knows what's coming and is familiar with it. And I do think once upon a time, a lot of business was built more on like, what kind of personal relationship do we have?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I always remember like even when I used to like work at a concert venue, there was like the older the salesperson you were talking to was, the more likely it was that you would like they would want to go like have dinner after work or get like drinks or something, as opposed to just have like a quick meeting in the conference room.
Sure, you know? Sure. Yeah. Or additionally, like I even feel like this happens sometimes, the difference between someone who like emails and phone calls.
Yeah.
Things. Like a phone call to me, it's almost like, oh, you want to get personal.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, we're going to speak on the phone with one another. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Must be a big deal.
Yeah.
So anyway, then we're basically getting ready to close out the chapter. Harry gets his just absolutely like after having such a laborious day of work, he is given his dinner of what is it like a slice of bread and a lump of cheese,
yeah.
Two slices of bread and a lump of cheese, mm-hmm. on a kitchen table. Meanwhile, they're what sounds to be a really spectacular feast that has been created otherwise. Like this almost feels like the type of thing where, like, again, you know, it's like Petunia must be like it's funny because like I feel like a lot of times Petunia is slammed for being extremely clean and neat,
yeah,
but like otherwise seems like, you know, like a rather capable cook.
Yeah, she must be. I mean, both of like her son and her husband are both fairly like portly.
Yeah, so like, yeah. What steps is she needing to go out of her way in order to create like negative grade meals for
I know
Harry,
right
you yeah. know like even like having made him like a grilled cheese, you know, when otherwise you've got this gleaming roast pork sizzling right,
like
in the oven.
All it would have taken was to like heat the ingredients you already gave him,
yes, yeah. And it would have been slightly better, but right. Instead it was just sort of like an irregular, like it even seems unlike Petunia to cut an irregular lump of cheese,
right?
Like she would almost have to be like breaking her own bearings,
right,
to be like, well, I'm just gonna rip a piece off and give it to him instead of like slicing it neatly,
which means that, like, yeah, there's not just one irregular shape piece of cheese now, like
right,
yeah. The whatever's left is also irregular because of the way in which you've given it to him,
right, right,
which feels very non-Petunia. But she's like, no, I can't give this man a nice even slice of cheese. He doesn't even deserve that.
A lump of cheese, and I'll throw the other lump away and then neatly slice whatever's left.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That seems more like
that
it.
That does seem like, yeah, yeah, a little bit more there.
So maybe the Dursleys are just forgetting his birthday on purpose. Is that, maybe I'm coming back to that.
I mean, the fact that she, absolutely they are, because like she makes a giant dessert, a huge amount of whipped cream and sugared violets, which I'm like, actually, maybe I should have looked this up, but sugared violets is like, I've always assumed that meant like berries or something, but like, is that like, this is clearly like a British thing where I'm like, did you sugar like flower petals?
I don't know. This is like one of those where like part of my mind almost went to like an iced rose that you might have on like a sheet cake. And now I'm just curious what a sugared violet might actually be. So I'm looking it up. Hang on one second.
All right. Sugared. You look up that. Otherwise, we have a loin of roast pork sizzling in the oven, which is also just like, that must be huge. Like you could clearly slice off like a piece for Harry.
Okay.
For goodness sakes. Oh.
I think that they are in fact violet petals that have been candied.
Hey!
Which you can apparently purchase on Amazon for $7.85, or fairisle.com has a recipe on how to make candied violets.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so that's pretty interesting. So violets are just an edible petal,
okay.
I suppose. Yeah.
All right. Well, very cool.
Yep. otherwise, yeah, we're closing out the chapter. This is... No, this isn't even the thing. So I was thinking about the permission slip, and like the negotiations. Like, you know, if you're quiet all night, like maybe I'll sign your permission slip. But that's not even on the table.
No, yeah, that's next book. Behave for Aunt Marge.
Right. But yeah. So it is very interesting. So then Harry goes up to his room. Basically, the Masons are about to come over. You can feel the stakes at the very least for Uncle Vernon, which I think sets the table rather nicely for just the absolutely disruptive nature that Dobby is about to provide to the house.
I mean, how big of a drill order does this have to be for them to comfortably think that on the next day they can be shopping for like a beach house?
Right.
You know, like what is the commission on the drills?
I know.
Like I've always assumed like he's selling like DeWalt like power tool drills, but like when you think about it like this, it's like, are you selling like like bulldozer size drills, you know, like construction vehicle size drills.
It could be augers. The case. Yeah, right. Yeah. Like that could absolutely be the case. I have seen, I think in the illustrated edition, like they refer to Grunnings as a boring company.
Yeah.
Because it's boring.
Yeah.
But you bore into stuff.
Maybe it is like huge drills then.
It could be. But then if he's a home builder, then you don't need huge drills. Like you would almost need more like your everyday like carryable drills.
Well, but maybe you're like drilling like straight into the ground to like lay the foundation or something.
That is possible. But yeah, I think you would need to be, in my mind, I'm trying to do like what feels like a reasonable commission that the Dursleys could be walking away with, that they'd be able to go and buy a vacation home. And so in my mind, I'm like, this must be at least a $5 million sale, such that a 10% commission could be $500,000 that could then be used to purchase a vacation home with. That's me backpedaling in my mind,
right?
Like, which would mean that, like, this would be a pretty eventful dinner. This is a pretty big deal.
I mean, it does make it seem like it's a very important like roast pork and pudding being prepared.
Can I just say though that I do find it to be slightly interesting that they find such a need to hide Harry, because it seems like, you know, even if they, like, it almost feels more likely that they would like be attempting to make Harry presentable on this particular occasion, because it's not exactly like uncommon for people to like show appreciation towards a family who has taken someone in need under their own roof.
I
think that would show like depth of character and like empathy and caring, mm-hmm. and like lots of positive traits. So like it's interesting to me that they think like the Masons don't know anything about you, nor will they.
Right.
And it's like, all right, whatever. Okay.
It also seems like maybe they just could have sent him to like Mrs. Figgs or something for the night. Like, why risk, if you're so concerned that Harry is going to unleash even the slightest bit of magic, like why even risk having him in the house if what's on the table is a beach house?
Right.
Get him out of there, man.
Yeah. Right.
You're playing with fire.
Seriously. So anyway, I guess next chapter we'll get the full breakdown of all the calamity that does ensue.
Indeed.
With chapter two.
Yes, chapter two, Dobby's Warning.
Oh, the little Dobsters.
Little Dobsters there. I got to tell you, the chapter art for chapter two, though, I won't talk about it now, but I'm not impressed.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I said it.
Shots have been fired. Okay.
Bam.
There we go. So book closed for the day. I'm not going to lie to you, Jay. I too was in a very similar camp, and maybe it fueled our tangents in some capacity. But coming into this chapter, I was like, this is such a big recap chapter. And there's a lot of like kind of reverse highlighting, you know, the previous story, the world that we live in, who the characters are, how they behave, you know, the underlying circumstances. So I'm impressed that we were able to go on as long as we did.
As am I. I will also say that I am impressed with our listeners, who I was just checking the YouTube channel before we got here. Of course, we have our goal of getting our silver play button for the Through the Gryffindor podcast YouTube channel. And we are presently at 22,000 subscribers on the YouTube channel. We're just like blowing my mind.
No freaking way. Yes, that's amazing.
So, just great milestone. We blew past 20,000. So we're aiming for, you know, 100 eventually, but just 25 right now. So if you haven't subscribed yet, you know, please do. Thank you so much for watching. It does absolutely mean a lot. I also, you know, I always like to check the charts to see if we're doing anything.
Yeah, naturally.
Really fun. You know, I'll say that presently we're doing well on the entertainment news section of various podcast things. We're presently number 5 in the USA.
No way!
On entertainment news.
Okay,
so that's
all right,
fun. And then I thought this was just sort of like, wow, that's surprising. But we are presently number 1, Ben, in Russia of all places.
Really?
Yes. So I was like, that's okay. All right. So if you're, I mean, thank you to all of our Russian listeners.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. That's really cool. That is really cool. So, as ever, you know, be sure to let us know like where are you tuning in from? And definitely if you're willing to go and leave us a review, we would certainly appreciate it. It helps with our discoverability as the show continues to grow a little bit over here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Speaking of which, I do have a review we can read.
Yeah. Later
right here. This, I don't know why it like, Apple feels the need to like mask people's names, so I can't tell you who left it because it's just listed as ICFZGDGDUHED.
Hey, well,
shout out
to them.
Shout out to They said, great podcast. I love listening to you guys go into depth on these books and pointing out things I've never noticed before. Question, what do you think, what house do you think Barty Crouch Jr. was in? I know most of the Death Eaters were in Slytherin, but we know that a few others have been in other houses like Quirrell or Pettigrew, so it's possible. My bet is either Ravenclaw because he's incredibly smart and talented, or Hufflepuff because he's extremely loyal to Voldemort. Also, the public seemed to doubt that he was a Death Eater even after he was arrested, so maybe that might have been something to do with him not being in Slytherin. So it's a little bit further ahead. This is from book four.
Yeah, it is indeed. But no, it's a very interesting question just off the nose that I'm almost surprised we haven't contemplated more before.
So, I know. You just sort of assume Slytherin.
You do sort of assume Slytherin, but I like the arguments. I mean, as the question was unfolding, Ravenclaw is what popped into my head.
Yeah.
Because it does seem like Barty Crouch Jr. is like a highly and uniquely capable person, wizard. Mm-hmm. Like, not only rather gifted magically, like, because is it the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Barty Crouch Jr., at least while Barty Crouch is under, I think he's talking to like a tree or something like that, but says that like Barty Crouch Jr. received 12 OWLs?
Yeah, I think, something like that.
So this would basically put him in standing with like Percy Weasley.
Right.
As far as we know, as like the only other like person capable of it. And because as like Hermione is the brightest witch of her time, and she doesn't even receive 12 OWLs,
right,
because she gives up the time turner after book three.
Does that mean Barty Crouch would have had a time turner?
Yeah, almost certainly.
Almost has,
yeah,
to have mean that. I love the idea. It is very fun to think about, but I think he's still in Slytherin.
Yeah, like
just
so
because,
much.
Like, because, like, when he's talking to Harry afterwards, I think he says the sentence, like, it required every ounce of my cunning to, like, guide you through the Triwizard tournament.
That's a good
point. Where it's like, he is constantly having to, like, problem solve on the fly, keep 1,000 lies straight, like, give off a certain vibe as Mad-Eye Moody, but then like never lose Harry's trust, stay like keep Dumbledore fooled, all while trying to like bring Voldemort back and deal with Harry, who from his point of view is just fumbling in every direction trying to get through it. So I think just the absolute level of cunning he displays while disguised as Moody to me paints him still like the most as a Slytherin.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very fair argument. One of the things that I think he's also just not given nearly enough credit for, and you kind of touched on a little bit, is just his sheer ability to act and stay in role, stay in character. Like, it's like, I've always wondered whether or not like Polyjuice Potion doesn't like come with a small amount of like awareness about like who the person is, or like some of their like more recent like thoughts or memories.
Oh,
or
right. Like, yeah. Like something like that. Yeah.
Can kind of like slightly help guide, you know, and I don't even know if it's like a feature or more of like a byproduct of the spell.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to like analyze all the other instances, like, you know, when Harry and Ron are under, in this very book, are under the Polyjuice as Crabbe and Goyle, like, are they like a little bit more thick?
Yeah.
You know, are they a little bit more like dim-witted or slow, or,
right,
or, you know, like struggling to think as quickly as either Ron or Harry would under certain circumstances.
Right.
And that would be then like a reflection of, you know, then Crabbe and Goyle sort of like integrating, you know, through the potion.
Right.
Or like, did it help during the Battle of the Seven Potters that like everybody under Polyjuice was like maybe that much better of a flyer?
Oh,
that,
yeah,
night, you know,
it feels like they would say it, you know, like it would be in the book, like that would be like brought up, but I guess maybe not.
I know, but I mean, that's the part, because like, you know, when you compare it to Quirrell with like Voldemort actually living on the back of his head for all of book one, like the fact that, you know, like Quirrell and Dumbledore aren't terribly close, but Mad-Eye and Dumbledore are quite close, and it doesn't seem like Dumbledore knows that Barty Crouch Jr. is underneath the veil.
Yeah.
Like, that's not part of Dumbledore's big plan. Like, that is foiling him
actively. It absolutely is at every step of the way, and like that is always like, that to me is like, it's such a bummer that Barty Crouch Jr. just gets like utterly defeated and like gets his soul sucked out at the end of Goblet.
I know.
Because it's like, man, like, because you don't even get to know it was him. Like, the whole, you know, you barely knew him as a character. You always thought he was Moody. And, like, the moment you find out, he's just gone.
I know.
And it's like, you could, like to the point where, like, the first time I read it, like, I couldn't have even told you Barty Crouch Jr. again. I just could have told you that, like, Moody wasn't Moody.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You like, just like, give, like, yeah.
Who is this straw-haired kid?
Yeah, who's the straw-haired kid? This, so, interesting question, though, then, is if, even if you, if Barty Crouch Jr. was in Slytherin, where was Barty Crouch Sr.? Like, was he, because they're a pureblood family, I believe,
I think you're right.
Yeah.
It seems like Barty Crouch Sr. was basically on a fast track to be Minister for Magic.
Yeah.
Both of them were probably taught by Slughorn, you know, who, like, then you feel like would have been, like, absolutely, like, you know, pulling ties, pulling connections.
Absolutely seems like Slughorn. But yeah, like, Barty Crouch Sr. must have been in the Slug Club because he can speak, like, 100 languages, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's a very... Yeah. He must have been. It must have been obvious how powerful he was. That's another one. You don't get to see him be powerful. You just sort of like are told he is very powerful.
Right. Yeah. Right. Which is really interesting. And it's like it kind of seems like, I mean, the key thing that then like detours him from ever becoming Minister for Magic is the incident with his son.
Yeah.
And everything that kind of subsequently follows. But like even that is one of those things where it's like if that doesn't happen, then the Wizarding World. I mean, we don't know enough to really know, but it seems like would probably be in much better hands than like with Fudge.
It definitely seems that way. And like, I feel like it would have been great to know that Barty Crouch Sr. was in Slytherin as well, because then that's just like one more like, maybe more like good Slytherin character. Not that he was great. Like he definitely does some like negative things, like with the sacking of Winky and stuff like that. And
yeah.
He's
yeah.
like, you know, even sending his own son to Azkaban. It obviously does the right thing because his son is very dangerous.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
But like he's a severe person, but he's like he is an effective person, and he does seem to be he is on the good side of things.
It gives you at least a better spectrum for people from House Slytherin, where otherwise, you know, it seems like they're so. They don't have a lot of depth, you know, like it kind of seems like for the most part, I mean, you've got Snape who like, you know, in some manner of speak,
right,
can redeem like, the house. But
yeah, I mean, that's the problem. It's like Snape, it's like there's always the talk about like, yeah, he was sort of a hero at the end. But then like also you didn't have to be so mean in the meantime. Like you were still like there's still reasons to dislike Snape even when you know his ultimate like secret.
Right.
And then like even Draco, it's like he kind of helps, but he doesn't get that like full redemption arc. He doesn't like full on help Harry at the end.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, denounce Voldemort. And like Slughorn's probably the best example of just like a generally jovial Slytherin guy. And look how he plays favorites. And he's sort of like a fun character, but like, yeah, there's, you know, it's all right.
Kind of comes with its own fault. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like very, very like creature comfort focused. I mean,
Seems
a little like full of himself in some capacity. So it's like if that's our
Those are our three best bets.
Yeah exactly. But this again, I mean, just to bring it full circle to the original, you know, kind of conversation we talked about with the founders as well, is that like when you go back to this idea of Salazar and Godric being like the best of friends, you know, like it's always interesting because I do sort of like have this like very jock like image for what Gryffindor would be like a very like ready fire aim kind of individual, just sort of like a little bit like haphazard and but like in a way that I feel like always kind of comes back to sort of like an upbeat and excited and noble way.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like it's not the worst version of what I just described. It's like the best version of what I just described. But for him and Salazar to have been a best friends, it's like they had to have been able to either be like puzzle pieces for one another, like where they're like kind of completing each other's faults.
And
like
right.
Maybe Salazar's like a bit more careful and that keeps Godric like out of danger. But like it makes me feel like Salazar must appreciate these kinds of behaviors out of Godric, which is something that feels so not in keeping with everything that you've ever been painted about this character.
About Salazar
otherwise. Yeah. So it's like, you have to imagine that like Salazar must like fun on some level if he likes Godric because, well, and I mean, I'm certainly like projecting my own images onto it. But like, you know, the thing that I would love to see in a founder series is so much like enjoyment and jovial nature and like kind of like lighthearted goofing.
I think so. Like, because if you have a founder series, the whole thing, like the finale is the crack.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Is
exactly.
Like splitting. So, but like if you have like five seasons, then you need 4.9, you know, seasons of them being the best of friends.
Yes.
Because it all has to be leading to how terrible the crack is and like how devastating that is. Because that leaving is still what you're seeing play out between Voldemort and Harry.
Yeah.
You know,
It's exactly like Rogue One, you know, like in the world of Star Wars. It was like, yeah, from the moment we saw the first trailer, we're like, well, prediction number one, everybody's going to die.
Right.
Sort of like you just sort of knew that that had to be what happened. And,
right.
And, you know, it is what happened, but it's not like, it doesn't make the movie not good in the process either, because like you're just seeing like important events play out. And, but like, you know, then you need to make the ride enjoyable because we know the destination. We know right. The destination is that they end up being split for some reason.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, in its best case scenario, it's devastating because it's like, because what you're witnessing is the loss of something that was otherwise so great.
It was so great. That's what has to be. That is, yes, it has to be so great. And that, yeah, I think that has to be like the core of that story has to be how good of friends, not just the, like all four of them especially, but like, I think it has to be like a show about friendship specifically amongst all four of them, but then even more so Godric and Salazar.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you would end up seeing is like episode, like in my mind, again, you know, as if somebody's asked me, but like, you know, it's like you'd have episodes where it's like, you know, this one's going to be like Godric and Helga off on an adventure.
Of course.
Salazar and Rowena off on an adventure and vice versa in every which way. But, you know, I think that you get to see each of their relationships, you know, kind of pieced together, but it seems as though the relationship between Salazar and Godric in particular is so critical to everything.
It is.
You know, it has reverberations for 1,000 years to come. It's like,
I know.
You
know, it's like someone's got to tell the story.
I know. Yeah.
And I would love it to be us if you're a Warner Brothers. If you're looking for people,
we could be your idea man.
We got it.
Anyway, guys,
love to consult.
Great review, by the way, because it lets down a whole other path. So be sure to leave a review if you want to tuck a question in there. We'd be happy to answer that as well. But as ever, guys, thank you so much for tuning in.
Yeah, we'll see you next time as we dive into Chapter 2, Dobby's Warning Through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager. And the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.